Thank you very much, Gabby. I won't be talking about an awful lot of subjects, and indeed, what I'm going to do is confine myself to basically three issues, beginning, no surprise whatsoever, with Gaza, more specifically with the demonstration yesterday. I don't know, what the numbers were. All I can tell you is it was enormous. I mean, I'll give you an idea. Our weekly worker team turned up at 11. We had a tiny difficulty finding each other. But more or less by 12, all the weekly workers that we could carry had been distributed. And I decided to do my bit for the weekly worker and start to learn the art of taking pictures. And to get also to get a handle on this demonstration, because here was a demonstration that was billed to rally at 12 o'clock, and the general vibe was, well, it will be setting off after about three quarters of an hour. Well, it already started. It already started to move at 12 o'clock, and indeed, I had to walk at a considerable lick to catch up with the front, which is eventually what I was able to do. And I walked all the way to Vauxhall Bridge and decided, well, there's no point me, trying to get over the bridge and then along the other side of the Thames to the US embassy to listen to the speeches. So instead, I just wanted to get an idea of who's on this demonstration. What groups, what individuals, what's the political character of it? And I basically set myself the aim to stay on, just on the edge of Vauxhall Bridge until the end. Well, they just kept coming, kept coming, kept coming. And so I decided at about, if you could mute yourself, Gabby, that would be an advantage. Thanks. I decided at about 4:30 that instead of waiting for the demonstration to pass me by, I would actually go back all the way down the road, all the way back to see if I could find the end. And in, I was meeting people and saying, "Are you the end?" And people would shrug their shoulders and say, I don't know." It kept coming, kept coming. And so eventually I arrived back at Victoria, the station, the bus station, that sort of area of London. The demonstration was still coming. It was still enormous, street end sort of type idea. And I saw the SWP contingent with two big, big banners pass me by. I then saw the Revolutionary Communist Group pass me by. And wow, that was at about 5 o'clock. And I'm presuming that that was the sort of political section which would have been left to the last. I mean, that's just a guess. So that is roughly a demonstration that from start, not to finish, but took me 5 hours. And that still left the tail behind, and it still got an awful long way to go before it crossed, if they ever did, cross Vauxhall Bridge. I don't know, I don't think anyone at the end would have got to the American embassy. It would just been too packed. So when the organizers were saying that it was 900,000, I'm sort of inclined to believe the figure. It was substantially more than 2 weeks ago. That was the last national demonstration. Last week, there were local demonstrations. That was the call from the various groups that are organizing these demonstrations. I saw helicopter pictures of Trafalgar Square in London last week, and that was certainly packed out. But that was a local demonstration. This time it was a national mobilization. Should be added that there were demonstrations in other centers, so in Glasgow. There was a demonstration in Cardiff. There was a demonstration, I'm sure that's true also for a whole lot of other towns and cities. Okay, so I can go with the idea that it was 900,000. The police were saying that it was 300,000. I mean, all I can do is report, how long. How big it was, and compare it with other demonstrations I've been on. And the only one I can think of that has any sort of comparison is the great anti-war demonstrations earlier this century, which of course ended in, not started, ended in Hyde Park, which gave you an idea of the enormity of that demonstration. So yesterday I sort of more gained an impression of enormity, not because it had all gathered in Hyde Park or some other area where you could arrive at some judgment, but simply on the basis of time. My guess for what it's worth is that the demonstration would have been more like 6 or 7 hours end to end. So by the time the end got to the destination, if people did, that would have been something like 7 hours. Okay, so what about the makeup of this demonstration? Hard to say, but given that I was there, from the head of the demonstration, not quite to the tail, but damn it, near enough. I would say it was a very mixed demonstration. I would say that there were a lot of people who, whose parents or who themselves came from the Middle East or South Asia. Nonetheless, what was also noticeable to me was the number of people who were visibly Muslim, who were wearing, for good political reasons, not that I approve, but nonetheless, this gives you an idea, red roses, the not roses, excuse me, the poppy, Armistice Day, and all the rest of it. And indeed, I did see one guy, for example, with his wartime medals. But the point I'm really trying to get over here is that this demonstration of 900,000, if that's a figure that's believable, and it's believable by me, was of a different character to the demonstration 2 weeks ago, the one that the organizers said there was 300,000. What was the different character of it? Well, I would actually say the slogans, the slogans both that were shouted and were carried. There were an awful lot more peace slogans this time. So calls for ceasefire, calls for peace. Attacks on Rishi Sunak were standard. Attacks on Keir Starmer were standard. A lot of, but a lot less proportionately in terms of the slogan, from the river to the sea. And I'll come to that slogan and the controversy that surrounds it later on. But a lot less of that and a lot more of what do we want? Peace now. What do we want? Ceasefire. That sort of slogan. Also ought to be added that there, as well as the red poppy, there were not a few white poppies. A lot of people of my generation who are obviously peaceniks going back to the second wave of CND, Pershing II, Ronald Reagan, that sort of generation. They'd been mobilized. In terms of the mobilization of the Muslim population, a lot of them were clearly self mobilized, mum, dad, daughter, son, grandkids. There were lots of people like that, but also a lot of mobilization by mosques behind banners that proclaimed, Newham or whatever the hell it happens to be. What was also worthwhile commenting on, and maybe you see with your eyes, but you're also seeing with this thing here in between your ears, you're seeing with your brain. And I was also, struck by the number of different Jewish organizations that were on the march, or individual Jewish people that had done, which is really a feature of demonstrations, I think, over the last, what, 20 years? Self-made placards, on the cardboard box. But the number of people that were saying, not in my name, I'm a Jew, something along those lines. The number of Jewish organizations that I'd never heard of that were saying, we disassociate ourselves from this action in Gaza in the name of being Jewish. So you had your usual suspects, the Jewish Voice for Labor, Jews Against Genocide. We had Gabby's unfavoritist Jews. She's got a letter in this week's Weekly Worker complaining about our front page. To me, the significant, and they were there, by the way, the ultra-Orthodox Jews. I can't remember the particular sect, but it should be pointed out that historically, Orthodox Jews wanted nothing to do with the Zionist project of Israel. That for them, the state of Israel, the recreation of Israel is associated with the coming of the Messiah. And no one's claiming that Ben Gurion or Golda Meir, these were secular labor Zionists who founded Israel. And indeed, if you look at Netanyahu's lot, the revisionist Zionists, they might claim that gods, in some bizarre way, gave the Jews the land of Israel, except they don't believe in God. So yes, it's only in recent years that we've seen the coming in Israel to the center stage of religious Jews, and also the change in countries like Britain. And I can't comment on America. I just don't know, and I don't know about France. I do know about Britain a little bit, of where you've seen a shift by people who religiously identify themselves as Jewish to a pro Israel state position. That's for them to reconcile, a circle that they have to square. But also, of course, the foundation of the state of Israel very quickly split the Jewish population, as it would do between not just secular Jews and religious Jews, no, but between anti-Zionist Jews. Zionism was made real, from a pretty abstract project, before 1917, the Balfour Declaration, the British allowing and indeed perhaps even encouraging Jewish migration, in the 1920s into the 30s. And I think the sort of cutoff date was about 1936, when inevitably the native population, the Arab native population, rebelled against the colonization of their land. Either way, the point I'm making is that there were both religious Jews on the demonstration on Saturday, and secular Jews. And of course, what they were there to do, of course, is to proclaim their opposition. And of course, given the attacks on this demonstration by the Home Secretary previously being a hate demonstration, being an anti-Semitic demonstration. Of course, what was noticeable when it came to the ultra-Orthodox guys lining up there with, Zionism is an abomination, against the Torah. I'm making that one up, by the way, but along those lines, or for that matter, secular Jews lining up and deliberately showing themselves to the demonstration. What, of course, was noticeable, doesn't take a genius to predict it. The demonstration bursts out into spontaneous applause, and that comes from all sections of the demonstration. So, of course, this wasn't a demonstration of hate, and indeed, there were loads of again self-made placards. We're here for love and peace, and we're not here for hatred, etc., etc., etc. So this demonstration was a real mobilization of the broadest masses, certainly when it came to the Muslim population of London, the southeast, and way beyond. I spoke to a guy in Hyde Park who just arrived from South Wales, for example. There were an awful lot of comrades, brothers and sisters. That came from all different parts of the country. And I'm talking about the political character of this demonstration, not to criticize, but simply to observe. It's what you would expect. Anyone who expects a demonstration of that size, that's come out of nowhere, in the course of a few weeks to have, and I'm using this very much tongue in cheek, politically correct slogans. Of course it won't. We expect the masses to have pacifist slogans. We expect people, to be marching, given Suella Braverman, with their red poppies. They were proclaiming that they were British. That's what they were doing. And they were, in their own way, putting up two fingers to the Home Secretary and the Tory government for the attacks on them. So, what about the question of arrests? For the life of me, even though I actually ended up going to Charing Cross in order to get home, because all the tube stations in that part of central London were closed, no buses, of course, were running. I had to have a long, long walk. It's good that I'm fit enough to have gone all that way. A lot of other people, who are older, would have had difficulties. I didn't see anything of the breakaway demonstration. This would be about, well, I'm just guessing, 5:30 by the time I got to Charing Cross in order to get home. But of course, it occurred the previous week as well. So there are reports of 150 arrests. But on the main demonstration, the character of it in general, was, and I often was standing next to police ranks just in case something happened, they would be, onto it like that sort of type idea. What was noticeable to me was the number of people that went by the police that were thanking them. Thank you for looking after us. And the police were friendly back. It was that sort of character on this demonstration. So isn't it an irony? When I got back, when I put my feet up, had a cup of coffee, I looked at the BBC for the coverage of the right-wing demonstration that was mobilized by Tommy Robinson, ex of EDL, English Defence League. He'd mobilized what? A couple of hundred people to Whitehall, supposedly to protect the cenotaph. Well, given that this demonstration started off at Hyde Park Corner, at 12 o'clock, 1 hour after they had their, was it 2 minute silence? I can never quite remember, but you know what I'm talking about. And went in an entirely different direction went over the Thames, had nothing to do with Westminster Bridge that goes over past the Houses of Parliament. Now, of course, there was never a threat of that. There was never a thought of that. So, isn't it an irony that I switch on the BBC and see the police fighting with batons against Tommy Robinson's mob, half of who actually look completely drunk, as far as I could see. Again, I'm only doing it visually. And indeed, the BBC was reporting, I couldn't quite hear it myself, that during the 2 minute silence, it was this right wing mob that were making a noise. And indeed, the right wing mob were quoting to the police as they were fighting them, Suella Braverman's words about her, her words about being soft on left wing demonstrations, on Muslim demonstrations, on peace demonstrations, on the Gaza demonstrations, and hard on the right. And so these people attacked police lines, attacked this holy ceremony of the British establishment, including during their 2 minutes. That was produced by Suella Braverman. And no matter how much Rishi Sunak and other government ministers try to muddy the two were completely separate. And indeed, I also read, talking about lies, I actually also read, I do recommend it, comrades, have a look at the Daily Express, if it's called that still. I had a look at their report on the demonstration. And if you read their report, it was the pro-Palestine, the Gaza demonstration that was responsible for the disturbances in Whitehall. They just seamlessly put the two together and didn't mention the right wing. So the report they published was if pro-Palestinian demonstrations, the pro-Palestinian demonstrators were responsible. They weren't. So what we have is a rabble-rousing government. And the tragedy of the moment is, of course, that this 900,000 demonstration, which of course is the tip of an iceberg by definition, is not politically represented. Because in essence, we have the same message, not only from Tory ministers, we have the same message in essence from leaders of His Majesty's, I've got to get used to that, His Majesty's loyal opposition, Keir Starmer. And why do we get that message? Is because what we're dealing with isn't electoral calculation in the narrow sense. What we're dealing with is strategic calculation. What we're dealing with is a situation where both the opposition and the government are tied to US imperialism. And as far as the United States is concerned, Israel is an unsinkable aircraft carrier. Why? Because Israel relies on US support. Israel is a settler colonial project without an imperial sponsor. It goes under. And the fact of the matter is, the mass easily, 95%, 97%, 99%, I don't want to push my luck, but I think it goes up to that sort of figure of Israeli Jews would vote for parties that tie Israel to that strategic partnership with the United States. If it isn't the United States, it has to be someone else. Look around the world and tell me what the replacement was and how it's gone in terms of the history of Israel. Is before the United States, it was France. That's how Israel got its nuclear bomb. Before that, it was the United Kingdom. And before that, Herzl, Theodor Herzl, and those that founded modern Zionism were looking around for various other imperial sponsors, which included the Russian Tsarist Empire and, of course, the colonial. Master of Palestine at the time, i.e., the Ottoman empire. All were tried, and it was only in 1917 did they get Britain to back them. And the idea of Balfour, who was an anti-Semite, of course, was that Britain gets its little Ulster in the Middle East. And Britain could also potentially, for anti-Semites such as him, Winston Churchill, and the like, get rid of the Jews. And so I just quote this one. When Herzl sent representatives to meet, I can't remember the name of the Minister of the Interior under the Tsars. It was a particular one. Doesn't matter. He was a pogromist, of course. Basically, they sent the message, look, you want the Jews out. We want the Jews out. Let's get together. It was as simple as that. Okay. So I think I've dealt with the demonstration, at least from my angle. And what I wanted to do now is just shift to a repetition of my critique of the comrades in the Socialist Workers' Party. They had an article by comrade Sophie Squire last week, and she was drawing a parallel between their call in the SWP for a single state solution. And they had an editorial this week that said, quite rightly, in my view, look, it's up to us how we interpret this slogan, from the river to the sea. And they go on to explain what the slogan means for them and what the slogan used to mean. It's not in the editorial, but what the slogan used to mean to the Palestine Liberation Organization and Fatah, which were founded in the early 1960s, what they meant by it. Now, if you look at the founding chart, I think, and this is from memory, so I could be wrong, but if you look at the founding charter of Fatah, that's a secular leftist organization, you know, Yasser Arafat and all the rest of it, they actually did have a position that says that Jews that have come to Palestine since 1948 ought to go back home. That is certainly true. But over the years, basically, what at least a section of the left and Fatah and the PLO have settled on is that's out of date, because the vast, vast majority of Jews, even with Russian migrants now in Israel, Palestine, and I use that word advisedly considering the West Bank, vast majority of them are now born in Israel. They are native Hebrew speakers. So, yes, there are large minorities that don't speak Hebrew as their mother tongue, as their first language. Nonetheless, this is no longer, you know, some artificial implant. This is now sort of organic in the same way, I suppose, that the American nation became, you know, after 1776. I'm not going to give a particular date. It doesn't really matter. Anyway, the comrades in the SWP this week have an editorial saying, look, we'll decide what we mean by from the river to the sea. It has got nothing to do with anti-Semitism. We stand for a single state, Palestine, in which all religions will be treated equally. And of course, what they mean by that fundamentally in Israel, Palestine, is the Jewish religion, the Muslim religion, and don't forget the Christian religion. There's a sizable minority of Christians amongst the Palestinian population, for example. And if I'm not mistaken, someone will correct me, wasn't George Habash the leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine? Didn't he come from, thank you, Ian, thank you. Didn't he come, for example, from a Christian background? He's one of many. Anyway, my point still is that's what the SWP understands by the slogan. That's what the Palestinian movement has understood by the movement. This is not, as Suella Braverman lyingly says, a project of exterminating the Jews. It's not a project for a second Holocaust far from it. It's a message of tolerance. Now, whether you think that's practical, we come to the problem. Because what the SWP does, rightly in my view, is dismiss the so-called two-state solution, promoted, they say, by the imperialists, which is true, by some, it's really now marginal in Israeli politics, Labour Zionism, and also the official Communist Party, which I think in Palestine is called the People's Party. And I think it's just called the Communist Party of Israel, in Israel, proper. But they are marginal, forces when it comes, to the Israeli Jewish vote. So, although the Communist Party, I think, has one MP who's Hebrew, or maybe two, I can't remember, their electorate is from the Arab population, the 20% of Israel proper's. Israel proper's population that has the vote. These people left MPs or Muslim MPs. Anyway, my main point is that the SWP forgets the left on this one. The Communist Party isn't alone in Israel advocating that. Most official Communist parties do that on the sort of I don't know. Post-World War II, borders are sacrosanct, sort of type idea. That seems to be the driving rationale. Either way, they quite rightly say that this is a false slogan. America doesn't really believe in it. Israel's Labour Zionists never really believed it. They talk the talk, they never walk the walk. So, as soon as Israel took the West Bank, 67, you had Labour governments in Israel planting colonies. And they even planted colonies in Gaza before they gave up. There's 2 million Palestinians packed in this tiny, tiny space. But the West Bank has been systematically colonized both by Labour and Likud. Zionists. And they say, I think quite rightly, the problem with a two-state solution is that Israel would never allow it. And if Israel isn't going to allow it, unless America dumped Israel, which isn't inconceivable, but it's very unlikely. I don't see any immediate prospect of that. It simply is not going to happen. And that's my problem precisely with a one-state solution. Because Sophie Squires the other week, drew the parallel with South Africa. Put very briefly, we're dealing with two different political economies. We're dealing with the political economy of a work colony of the sort the United States, New Zealand, Australia were. I use the term past tense deliberately, i.e., you sent colonists mainly from one country, we'll call it Britain. These people were there to work. They were there to be farmers. They were there to work in steel, in iron, transport. They were the labor force. That was a problem in the United States, a problem in Australia. But their attitude towards the natives wasn't to enslave them. It's a difficult job making slaves of natives. It can be done, but it's difficult. No, the natives were there to be reduced, to be crushed, to be killed. That was their fate. And we saw that in Australia. I think that if you look at the Aborigine population in Tasmania, it was more or less completely exterminated. They had, bounties on the heads of Aboriginal, the First Nation people. It's true also in America, bounties for scalps. That wasn't a native invention. This was the colonists wanting to wipe out. Who wiped out the buffalo and why, etc., etc.? They wanted to exterminate these people because they wanted to take the land. And of course, what you had with Britain and Europe is more or less an endless supply of colonists. And that, of course, is a problem for Israel, that roughly speaking, in terms of the global Jewish population, half are in Israel. The next number is in the United States. Maybe it's France next. I'm not sure. Either way, there ain't that many Jews. But nonetheless, that is the project of Israel, to found a work colony. That was the project of Zionism, going back to Herzl. He wanted the Jews to stop, in his view, being flabby and soft, and wanted them to grow muscles, become warlike, like other peoples. And the difference, and this is crucial, is between a work colony and an exploitation colony. And South Africa was a classic exploitation colony. And you can use the example of the mines in South Africa. You know, if I said, what were the color of the guys with the pickaxe? What were the color of the people with the shovels? You'd say black, and I'd say absolutely right. And that was something that was introduced, I think, in about 1921. You had the color bar, and we won't go into the details. Who are the supervisors? They were white. The whites went home to their nice houses with a swimming pool, with a servant at the end of the garden. The blacks were there to work. They didn't want to exterminate them. They just wanted to crush them. That's the difference. And what you had, therefore, is a political economy that relied on native labor. That is not the situation with Israel. So drawing a parallel between South Africa and Israel is a profound mistake. We can talk about apartheid, and often that leads people to put an equal sign, but we're actually dealing with absolutely, totally opposite versions of colonialism. And therefore, the SWP is quite right that when it comes to a two-state solution, Israel, and I mean by that the population, the Jewish-Israeli population, won't allow it. But they will also not allow a situation of where they will be reduced to second-class citizens, because that's what the SWP proposes, because it proposes equal religious rights, which is great, isn't it? If you happen to be religious. I don't know what the statistics are. I'm sure someone on this talk will, either look it up or know it, more likely to know it, knowing this lot. But I, as a throwaway, would say at least half the Israeli Jewish population would call themselves secular. They might have been married in a synagogue, because you have to in Israel. Nonetheless, they don't believe in God. They don't carry out the practices of the Orthodox, or for that matter, the liberal or reform synagogues. Anyway, the point I'm making is precisely that's why the SWP are right when they say you need a regional solution. What they make the mistake of is simply saying that the overthrow of the existing governments in the region is all that's needed. They quite rightly, for example, locate the crucial role of Egypt. I mean, I don't know what the exact population of Egypt is, but I think someone told me earlier today that it's around 100 million, makes it easily the most populous Arab country in the world. Cairo itself, if you include next door city, Giza City, which is a bit like Budapest, both sides of the Nile. 20 million people live in that one city. So Cairo has more Arabs in it than there are Arabs in Israel, Palestine, for example. So they're quite right to say that the regional question is crucial. The problem I've got is the most likely overthrow of the Sisi government is going to come from the Muslim Brotherhood, which was the main organization that benefited from the overthrow of Mubarak. And that was predictable. Why? Because the Muslim Brotherhood is well organized. It has a cadre, it has a leadership, it has a history. It knows how to engage in mass politics. And the idea that some, Egyptian version of the Bolshevik Party will emerge from nowhere, and storm the heavens with the overthrow of the Sisi government, which is quite conceivable under these conditions. That's for left-wing mythology. That's got nothing to do with the actual history of real Bolshevism, as opposed to imagined Bolshevism. So, okay, you get your Muslim Brotherhood regime in Egypt. What then does the Israeli Jewish pop? How do they react to that? Do they say, "Brothers, come over"? The idea is ridiculous. No, you actually do need the idea of working class leadership. You need to at least pose it. You need actually a strategy, at least has the possibility of splitting, winning over a big chunk, maybe the majority, hopefully the majority of the Israeli Jewish population to our side. And you can only do that if you've got a program that makes the Israeli Jewish working class part of the new ruling class. That's what we're talking about. So this is why not only the SWP are absolutely right of why a two-state solution is inconceivable. It simply ain't going to happen. But they're also, out of their own mouths or out of their own pens, keyboards, they're also quite right, but accidentally in explaining why the one-state solution also isn't a runner. Just finally on the SWP, showing the problem with the SWP. They end their editorial by saying, look, keep marching, occupying, striking until Israel is beaten. And to me, this shows you the impotence and the problem with protest politics, that protest politics is great. I mean, yesterday was a fantastic demonstration. I'll remember it, until I die. It was fantastic seeing 900,000 people out on the streets of London, defying the Tory government, defying Suella Braverman and her attempt to get this demonstration banned, her attempt to copy Germany and France by branding these demonstrations as anti-Semitic when they clearly aren't. But okay, so you bring out 900,000. Maybe, in a few weeks' time, we equal the turnout. And that seems to be where things are going. Maybe we equal the turnout of Stop the War Coalition in the early part of this century. Remember, those that were there know it. People kept telling me it yesterday. Look, last time we came out in such numbers, it did not stop the war. Now, of course it didn't, because what we need to do is go beyond the politics of protest to the politics of power. And to do that, we need a party, not a respect party, not any old party, but a working class party that can coordinate in our terms across Europe, in Israel-Palestine terms across the whole of the Middle East region, crucially, I would say, that can coordinate with the proletarian movement in Egypt. I mean, Syria is important, Lebanon is important, Jordan is important. Egypt, though, is absolutely crucial. So we need to go beyond the mindset that demonstrating, striking, occupying is enough. That will not beat Israel. And what I mean by Israel, of course, is Zionist Israel. In my own approach, which is shared by others, in the Weekly Worker and around the Weekly Worker, what we talk about, not advocate, what we talk about is the right of the Israeli Jewish population, where they are historically established majority, right? So not the West Bank, not Jerusalem, but Tel Aviv, most certainly, to the right of self-determination up to and the right to separate. Now, that is something that some, how should I put it, less experienced comrades and comrades on the left who ought to know better interpret it as a call for independence. It is no such thing. It's like going outside a church or a registry office and saying that men and women have the right to divorce. Yes, they do. They ought to. That doesn't mean we advocate divorce. No, quite the opposite. We advocate it when it comes to peoples, the merger of peoples. We want the Arab population and the Jewish population in Israel, Palestine to merge, to become one. How they do it, I don't know. That's up to them. It's usually they work together, they fall in love together, they have children together, they bring them up bilingual together. It's that sort of a process which we consider a progressive. We want to overcome antagonisms between peoples, and the best way, the only sure way of doing that, the only civilized way of doing that is voluntarily. And so we want to overcome the fear that's either artificially generated from, by politicians such as Suella Braverman, Rishi Sunak, but also those politicians in Israel, such as the Labour Zionists and the Likud Zionists, and the people, you have to say, are just, to the far, far right, even of Netanyahu. These people will put forward the idea the only thing that the Palestinians are interested in is exterminating a new Holocaust. If anything is preparing the ground for a new Holocaust, I have to say it's the Zionist project, which is something Karl Kautsky warned about, and I'll get the title right this week. I hope, are the Jews a nation? And he answered, no. A nation, race, excuse me for that. But did say that the Zionist project sets up Jews who go there for a giant pogrom. We should take that warning seriously. Okay, moving on, and I'll try to limit myself to an hour, so I'm going to be quick, and I'm not wanting to deal with the other two subjects at length, simply on the basis, not because they're unimportant, but simply on the basis of keeping things within the hour. Okay, very quickly. We have scientists telling us that they expect 99% certainty that 2023 will be the hottest year on record. And that's roughly speaking, we're talking about modern records. That's roughly speaking about 150 years. We had the two hottest months. I think it was March, and was it July? Those 2 months were over 1.25 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. So, why do I raise this? One, because we have this almost certainty that this will be the hottest year. But we also have later this month COP 28 in, of all countries, the UAE in Expo City, Dubai, of where they will be reviewing the progress they're making in terms of fulfilling the pledges that virtually, I think it's every country now, is signed up. The Paris Accords 2015, which is to limit global warming to under 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels, preferably, if not to 2 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. Well, look at the statistics. If that was going to be doable, what we should be seeing is a more or less 45 degree angle drop in the consumption of fossil fuels. That's what we should have been seeing. And instead of that, we're actually seeing maybe an evening out, but it ain't even even. So, for example, and this could be complex, because of factors like the Ukraine war and other things like that. Nonetheless, what we have is statistics saying that in 2023, 1% more fossil fuel will be consumed compared with 2022. Now, we should add in to this prediction that the El Nino, this is this climate pattern in the Pacific, is partially responsible for 2023 looking like it will break all records, not only for the last 150 years, but in terms of geological records for the last 120,000 years. And the problem precisely is that you have this idea put forward by the Sunak government and Labour, potential government isn't going to do anything about it. Is what you have is this idea, well, come 2030, we'll start cutting emissions. The problem is what you're dealing with, if we're going to use an analogy, it's a good analogy, is the oil tanker. Oil tankers cannot be turned around on a sixpence. And what you're building in, the more fossil fuel you use up, so all the North Sea concessions, all the stuff about, against the ULEZ zones, all the stuff, about keeping, prices down, we'll keep burning coal, we'll keep burning gas, we'll keep burning oil, and all the rest of it, is what you do, you actually add to the momentum of global warming. So, for example, what we would expect if there was suddenly a situation of where we were zero net emissions, you'd still have global warming for at least the next 100 years, because the ice caps will keep melting, sea levels will keep rising, and as a result of that, air temperatures will keep rising, and that means more ex you know the thing, more extreme weather, more extreme drought, more floods, more cities that will have to be abandoned. And this one touched me. I can't remember the name of the island, Tulva, maybe that's it's in the Pacific, it's low-lying. Australia, the Australian Labor government has been generously said to the population, you can have residence visas to Australia because they expect the island to be submerged. Well, isn't that generous of them? Of course, Australia is one of the great producers of fossil fuels, coal, which has historically been burnt, of course, in the world's second largest economy, China, but also countries now like Britain. Okay, so that was my quick comment on that. So I now have 5, 6, 7 minutes to finish. I'm just going to begin here with the news that Socialist Appeal, we've had a few comrades at their school this weekend. They've come hotfoot with the stunning news. That the comrades are going to rename their organizations. They're going to stop being Socialist Appeal. And they're going to become, again, in terms of their historic origins, they're going to become the Revolutionary Communist Party. This was an organization of Trotskyist unity, 1944, and it ended in disunity, 1948. And it's the sort of origin of most of today's Trotskyism. So, SWP, Tony Blyth, all come from that organization. SPEW come from that, what's they call themselves? Anti-capitalist resistance. They all have their sort of origin somewhere back then. They're also going to rename their paper. They're going to call it The Communist, which, of course, was the name of the paper, the CPGB, in the 19. 20s, early 20s, if I recall correctly. Should be pointed out, again, this is not me, I wasn't there. The turnout to the school, I think, will be disappointing to the comrades. So I'm told that the turnout was 400. They sold 1,000 tickets. My guess is that the poor turnout, if it was a poor turnout, after all, 400 compared with 1,000 tickets is explained by the demonstration on Saturday. They weren't there as an organization. No one was selling their paper, but their periphery, I'm sure, was on the demonstration on Saturday. So I don't know if there was a big change in terms of Sunday. I just don't know. Other comrades can tell us later in the discussion. But 400, I think, actually would be more what their membership is like. But even that would need qualifying because not all the 400 purport, that I'm told were Socialist Appeal members. So maybe 300 were. But then you've got comrades from abroad, various countries in the different sections of the international Marxist tendency were there. They add up. So we're dealing with, in terms of the left, a real organization, but we're not dealing with anything particularly large. Very welcome news from our point of view that the organizers, as opposed to the SWP, who unleash goons against our comrades and other comrades on the left, they allowed the Weekly Worker to be distributed, showing the change in culture. I've told comrades this, if you live in London, you are used to free papers. People like me, even old folk like me, don't carry cash anymore. You try selling a paper on a demonstration, people naturally assume it's the equivalent of the Evening Standard, London's daily evening paper. Anyway, they allowed the distribution of the Weekly Worker, which is excellent news because the danger that there is with Socialist Appeal changing their name to the Revolutionary Communist Party is that they carry on in the same way, pretending that the rest of the left don't exist or the rest of the left are an irrelevance that can be dismissed as sectarians buzzing around the labor movement, quote unquote. They're as much as a sect as anyone else, and they are not distinguished, Alan Woods, leader of Socialist Appeal, because you're an enthusiast that you think the revolution is around the corner. Do you really, after year after year after year retailing this nonsense, do you really believe it? I don't know. Maybe he does. Either way, the point needs to be made that if you talk to the SWP, if you read their internal bulletin, if you read Socialist Worker, if you read your old comrades in the socialist in the Socialist Party in England and Wales and their Tusk campaign, they're also putting forward the idea that the big change is just around the corner. We all remember it was great, the great strike wave, defensive, not militant, that we've just been through. Socialist Appeal and all the rest of the left, virtually with very few exceptions, were telling their young comrades that this is the, threshold of revolution. Nonsense. Trade unions were not about to lead revolution. None of the left were in a position anywhere near exercising anything remotely like hegemony. Either way, it's very positive news from my angle that people are calling themselves communists. The way it's dressed up, though, I do worry a little bit. They call it the communist turn. And what that triggers in my mind is Trotsky's French turn, where he told his comrades to enter the parties of what we would call the Second International. Trotsky had a lot more reason strategically, not that that was a strategic turn, but a lot more strategic reasons for taking that turn than Alan Woods does. Alan Woods, as I understand it, justifies this communist turn on the basis, bizarrely, that according to some opinion polls in the United States, 20% of young people call themselves communists. Well, one, that's in the United States. And maybe they call themselves communists because, the Republicans call them communists. I don't know. But it does remind me of the justification for Peter Taft's, or at least a section of his organization. Remember the Scottish Turn? The justification for having a separate organization in Scotland and for shifting towards pursuing Scottish independence was that young people, not Scottish people, but young Scottish people favored independence. What are we, a polling organization? What's it say in the Communist Manifesto? Communists deign not to conceal their views. Well, in my estimate, what we have with socialist appeal is marketing. Ever since I've known them, they've been clause for socialists. And anyone who knows anything about clause for socialism knows that this was a formulation put into the Labour Party constitution under the guidance of Sidney Webb, the Fabian, who looked at Marx's critique of the Gotha program and made it as anti-Marxist and as pro-Lassallian as he could get away with. And that's what the Labour Party voted for in 1918. This wasn't a declaration of going over to Marxism. This was going over to a bourgeois socialism. So the fact that Woods has abandoned that, I think, is good. How they justify it, they've got to come out with more, surely, than this is good marketing. They've got surely to do more than rename their own organization, rename their paper. What are they going to tell us when we criticize Clause 4, that that was just good, cynical? No, communists should not be cynics. Communists should be truthful with the working class. That's why we have a press. That's why we have an organization. We defy the Suella Bravermans of this world. We strive to tell the truth. So it's good news that they've made a name change. And it's good news. I was very glad that the comrades allowed the Weekly Worker to be distributed, as opposed to in Marxism, the SWP school, where they literally unleash people to physically attack you, to stop you giving out leaflets or stop you selling or distributing a paper. I'm sure I've gone over time, 3 minutes over time. So apologies for that, but hopefully it was worth it.